gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. This world stops turning, ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power, and as God has struck the hour, day of judgment, God is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling. Begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh, Lord, yeah.
thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining this program, we're listening to the mind of a conspiracy theorist. Stephen Lewandowski talks to Chris Mooney about conspiratorial thinking, and as we join them, they're discussing the conspiratorial thinking concerning global warming.
They think it's ideological. They think that you want to bend the world's governments to your way of seeing things.
Oh, yes, yeah. The world government, well, indeed. Yes, absolutely.
But just to be fair, they think it's an ideology counter to theirs, and you do anything you can to advance it, including making the puppets move.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. Now, what's interesting about this is that when you start to think about it, given how overwhelming the evidence is in all the cases that I've mentioned, when you're looking at HIV and AIDS, when you're looking at the effectiveness of vaccinations, when you're looking at the evidence for climate change, it is so absolutely overwhelming that if you can't handle that, what are you going to do other than invent a conspiracy amongst the scientists? I mean, in a sense, it's a very logical thing to do. If 97 out of 100 climate scientists tell us that the globe is warming from greenhouse gas emissions, well, and you don't like that for whatever reason, maybe because you got money from Exxon, what are you going to do about it? Well, really, the only thing you can do is to say, well, those 97 out of 100 climate scientists are engaged in a conspiracy. And so a lot of people are now saying that. And it's exactly the same with AIDS denial. The evidence is absolutely, totally overwhelming. So how do you dismiss that? Well, President Mbeki of South Africa, who rejected the evidence that linked HIV to AIDS, he called it racist Western medicine, and therefore was able to dismiss it basically by invoking a conspiracy. And the same is true wherever you look. When there's science denial involved, the people who don't like the science are often invoking a conspiracy.
I'm interested to unpack a little more the trait aspect of this. You said it's in part a cognitive style, a way of thinking. Is there something more deep, some other kind of set of traits, some kind of person? I mean, we hear the word paranoid a lot.
Yes, that is correct. There is, again, a statistical association between the propensity to endorse conspiracy theories and some paranoia, some tendency to feel persecuted. And there's also an association between people's disgruntlement and their disappointment with society and their economic insecurity that predicts whether or not they're likely to endorse conspiracy theories. So there's a literature that is painting a fairly consistent picture of what kind of people tend to engage in conspiracy theorizing. Now, what's interesting is, to me at least, is that actually there isn't a reliable association with politics or political leanings or people's worldview in that. Mm-hmm. You get the occasional association with right-wing thinking, but you equally also get it on occasion with quote-unquote left-wing thinking. And on balance, I think it is actually not related to politics at all.
So here's the question. Is it normal or abnormal psychology? I mean, it seems like a lot of people get down on their luck and want to blame somebody. Paranoia doesn't seem to me to be a rare thing, certainly not in United States.
Politics.
I mean, this is a pretty conspiratorial thinking is common. It's not something like, I don't know, schizophrenia or something. It's much more common than that.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's extremely common. I mean, in fact, if you look at the data last year or 2 years ago, the majority of registered Republican primary voters, I think it was 51%, thought that President Obama was born outside the U.S. Now, that's effectively a conspiracy theory.
Sure.
Of course
yeah.
It is. You know, you got to assume that a birth certificate is faked. And you got, I mean, you know, it's just a
And people are covering up the faking of the birth certificate.
Oh, not only that, but they also forged a newspaper from.
Right. Oh, yeah. You have to have the newspaper evidence of the birth.
The whole thing is just you just take one look at it. Frankly, you think it's ridiculous. And yet more than half of, you know, the Republican primary voters endorsed that conspiracy theory. So clearly it's very widespread. Clearly, I think except perhaps in extreme cases, it would be wrong to consider it to be a pathology. I never say that. I'm very careful about that. And I usually call it a cognitive style because it is really a style of thinking. And let's not forget, it's a very attractive style of thinking.
Is it, though? What does it say about you that you think the people who disagree with you or oppose you have borderline superpowers? I mean, you know, I have been in all kinds of arguments public, and given what I now know about psychology, I am sure that biases have crept into my thinking, and I have been inclined, especially on first impression, to think negatively about someone I'm arguing with, and probably, and what's important is to check this, I mean, probably be more willing to believe something that someone says than I should, because I'm just, you know, the initial disposition is negative, and you want to always check that, but we're all biased. But I never think that they're somehow super competent. I mean, I don't want to give that much credit. Like, they have, like, better abilities. You know, that doesn't follow at all, right?
Yeah, well, yes, I think you're right. At first glance, it is. I mean, I would love to be an all-powerful conspirator, actually, because then I wouldn't have to worry about anything in life. But yeah, no, I agree. That is certainly one aspect of it. But don't forget, one characteristic of conspiratorial thinking is that they never actually quite think it through. Okay. So they never get to the point where, and this is one aspect of conspiracy theories, that they're never internally coherent. They're basically just a concatenation of thoughts or sound bites, each of which is attractive. And you can say things like that. Oh, the president wasn't born in Hawaii. You know, it's very easy to say that. And it gives you, you know, it's a tool to dismiss him because he's a political opponent. Now, no one really thinks that through, as we have just done, you know, a couple of seconds ago by saying, gee, how did they forge the newspaper? How did they, you know, think? No one ever goes that far, or most people don't. And
you can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
As a special holiday treat, we now present a frightening story that will haunt you and your children for years to come. To help tell this morose tale, as Frankenstein, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. In the role of Igor, please welcome President George W. Bush. And as the bride of Frankenstein, Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
I was working in my office late one night when my eyes beheld a Wall Street fright. Lots of bad loans that were risky debts were crumbling, just like the New York Mets.
They needed cash.
They needed monster cash.
They needed cash.
We need it in a flash.
They say there's cash.
Taxpayers' teeth will gnash.
If they sound brash.
But we need a monster cash.
We've seen the housing bubble burst when Congress got involved and went from bad to worst. If I'd run the Titanic when it's submersed, I'd have yelled bankers and brokers first.
They need some cash.
There'll be a monster clash.
Over this cash.
We need it in a flash.
We want the cash.
If we don't get this cash,
without that cash,
there'll be a monster crash.
Now, I've studied history, and I'm telling you, we beat the Big Depression because of World War II. So now a new solution has occurred to me. How about to end this crisis, we start World War III. Or
we'll get some cash.
Cash, good.
For example, one of the interesting things about conspiratorial thinking is that people often hold completely contradictory theories in their head at the same time. So, for example, there's evidence that if somebody thinks that MI5 or MI6, whatever, whoever it is, the bad guys, that they killed Princess Diana, the person who will say that is also likely to say that Princess Diana faked her own death. Now, if she faked her own death, she's alive. If MI6 killed her, she's dead. You can't have it both ways. And yet, people will endorse both of those. And that's an aspect of conspiratorial thinking as well, the sort of complete incoherence.
But don't forget, it offers comfort. I said this before, that having an enemy, being able to label something as an enemy, paradoxically can give you a sense of control and comfort. And here's another thing about a conspiracy theory that makes it extremely attractive. It explains absolutely everything,
right,
by definition. So it can explain the slightest anomaly that is observed in a complex event, such as the 9/11 terrorist attacks. You know, it can explain that. All you have to say is, ooh, it's a government conspiracy, and they took away this piece of evidence we should have found, like the flight recorders or whatever it was. So it is always, a conspiracy theory always has an advantage over the true scientific theory, because a conspiracy theory can explain absolutely everything. All you got to do is just invent some other government agent who contributed that part.
Let's talk about how this plays out in your actual research on climate change and, well, the people who deny it. Now, you had this study, I guess it was about a year ago. It was in Psychological Science, and it disentangles the idea that this is political free market ideology from the idea that this is conspiratorial.
Indeed.
They're two separate things, overlapping things. Why don't you explain?
Okay, well, that's very interesting. What happened there was that we surveyed visitors to climate blogs, about 1,000 of them, more than 1,000. And we found that the overwhelming factor that determined whether or not people rejected climate science is their worldview or their ideology, whatever you want to call it. And specifically, people who are very enthusiastic and endorse a laissez-faire version of the free market, they tend to reject climate science. Now, that's been known for a very long time. You know, we know that there is a very strong association between worldview and the rejection of climate science. And what my study additionally showed was that there was a separate factor that was actually not related to worldview, that predicted rejection of scientific propositions, not just climate science, but also the link between tobacco and lung cancer and the link between HIV and AIDS. And that separate factor was conspiratorial thinking. And so the extent to which people endorsed a number of conspiracy theories predicted the rejection of those scientific propositions. Now, what's interesting here is that the strength of that link was far greater for tobacco and AIDS than it was for climate science. In fact, for climate science, it was a very weak relationship. But it was notable. It was certainly there in the data. It was statistically significant. And clearly for a number of people, not a huge number, but for a number of people, conspiratorial thinking determines their rejection of science. And yes, that paper caused quite a bit of interest.
Well, let's go to that in a second. But does this mean that a left-wing person who's a conspiratorial thinker might be a climate science rejector? Those people are out there?
Oh, yes.
And it's it's the conspiracy factor having nothing to do with the ideology factor.
Indeed. That's what we found in those particular data.
They're rarer, I guess, than the free market ideology.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But they're there.
They're there. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, no, and that's what's important to bear in mind, that we have not found, and I mentioned this before, there is no clear association between conspiratorial thinking and your politics. You know, you can get it both ways, one way or the other. And some particular conspiracies tend to have a political identification. For example, the notion that 9/11 was an inside job tends to be associated with people on the political left, whereas this notion of the world government, you know, the United Nations is trying to create a world government, that tends to be associated with people on the political right. So there are some individual theories that have a clear political identification. But by and large, if you look at the whole space of theories, they tend to be overall, I think, independent of politics.
So yes, this study created a dramatic response, and you might say that the response itself was conspiratorial, including alleging that the Australian government was involved in your study, or the response to it. How does it go?
Ultimately, yes, it became very interesting. And to be honest, when we published this first paper, I thought, yeah, okay, this is sort of, you know, a 4,000 word paper that does make a point that's interesting to know about, and so why not put it out there? Well, turns out that the response was quite vigorous, and the people who engage in the rejection of climate science, you know, on blogs and so on, were stimulated into, well, lots of things.
And it was because the study was of blog readers that the bloggers were engaged so much, right?
I guess so. It was, yes.
And climate science, obviously the topic too.
Obviously the topic too. I think it was the topic as well as the fact that it was visitors to climate blogs who were the participants in that study. So I don't know. I think there was a lot of reasons why they were quite upset about this study and began to create a lot of internet traffic discussing this study. And some of the thinking that was exhibited by the blogosphere, I'll call it generically the blogosphere, because there were so many people involved that you really can't talk about individuals. You can just talk about this organism, this blogosphere out there. The type of thinking that they exhibited was, well, conspiratorial. It looked just like what we were studying, much to our amazement. I mean, we were not prepared for this, but then we thought, well, this is really interesting. This is actually exactly what we're talking about. Because all sorts of hypotheses were advanced about myself and my co-authors and the study, which were quite peculiar. So, for example, we were accused of not having contacted skeptic, quote-unquote, bloggers to post the link to our initial study because it was an online study, and so the links were placed at various blogs. And I approached, I forget now, four or five skeptic, quote-unquote, blogs to post the link, and none of them did. Well, I said that in the method section, as you would. I said, you know, I contacted four or five, and none of them posted the link. Well, that was not accepted by the blogosphere. They said, well, no, that can't be right. That's not true.
And the reason is that they thought that if you only had blogs that accepted global warming, that therefore your sample would be wrong. But that's not necessarily true because people of both persuasions read.
Indeed. Right? And all you have to do is look at the comment streams on blogs that are...
Well, people argue back. Yeah.
People argue back. Yeah. So where do the comments come from? Right. I mean, you know, clearly people visit each other's blogs. I mean, the proportion of skeptics versus people who endorse the science may be different between the different blogs, but there's no question that people visit each other. So, I mean, that wasn't, you know, in itself a fairly weak argument. But then the accusation that we hadn't contacted these people was just bizarre. I mean, if we hadn't, why would we say that we did in the method section? And so this hypothesis just, you know, kept on going. And initially I was reluctant to release the names of these people I contacted because for ethical reasons, you know, I invited them to participate in research and they either didn't answer or declined to do so. And I wanted to check whether it's okay to release those names, which I did with my university's lawyer ultimately. And he said, oh, go ahead, release the names. So I finally did. Turns out that I think pretty much all of the people or virtually all of the people I contacted had stated previously, just a week earlier, that they were never contacted by me or my research assistant. So they, you know, the dog ate their email or something, you know, their inbox was corrupted and they couldn't retrieve the email. Now, you would think that that would make people think, oh, okay, right, we were wrong. You know, Lewandowski did contact the skeptic blogs. Here's the email. I released the email. I showed it. You know, they were publicly available now.
So wait, you published the emails you sent?
I certainly published the names of the people. And in the meantime, a Freedom of Information request was launched to my university for release of those emails. So ultimately, they were released by me, everything. And of course, I had the emails. And of course, I did contact those people. And in fact, some of them replied back and talked. You know, we had a little conversation by email.
They just forgot.
Yeah. Perfectly fine. Not a problem. I hold no grudge against that. Yeah. You know, that can happen.
At American University, President John F. Kennedy speaks to the graduating class with a proposal of a test ban treaty.
I have chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. To secure these ends, high-level discussions will shortly begin in Moscow, looking towards early agreement on a comprehensive test ban treaty. To make clear our good faith and solemn convictions on this matter, I now declare that the United States does not propose to conduct nuclear tests in the atmosphere so long as other states do not do so. The United States, as the world knows, will never start a war. We do not want a war. We do not now expect a war. This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.